Hello. And welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. Every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Thanks so much for joining us today. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so I've invited two instructors and advocates from Vashon's Dove Project to give us some tips on identifying domestic violence in friends and neighbors and ways in which we can help. Please welcome Nin Gray and Rashan Rengi, who is also a licensed therapist. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Susan. It's great to be here today.
It's so nice to have you, and I really appreciate you taking the time, especially during what might be a busy month.
It's a very That's busy an month. Understatement, right?
Okay.
Maybe our busiest month of the year for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely.
You know, I once heard that the busiest times for therapists are change of season, essentially, October and April. Is that true?
Rashan is a therapist, so she could answer that, but I've heard that same thing.
Yeah, like with seasonal affective disorder and the changing of seasons can be very difficult with light and being available to be out and about. It's a pretty tough time.
Huh. I remember reading one time, too, that even in the spring, the increase of light can sometimes be a disconnect for people who are struggling with depression, because they expect to feel better when there's more light and more daylight, but then they don't. So there's that dissonance, and then there can be an increase in that in the spring. I read that somewhere. I don't know if that's true or if you've noticed
it's possible,
that. But yeah.
Interesting. So let's get the Dove calendar straight. What is Dove doing this month to raise awareness of domestic violence?
Yeah, so October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, as you've already said. And, you know, one of the first big things that we do is the Purple Lights campaign, which we do with over of the 50 businesses on Vashon. So we put up purple lights and We Believe Survivor sign just as like a visual representation of the support and the belief that we have for survivors.
We also hosted some art and artists on First Friday. So we had a little party at Dove. It was so nice just to open the doors. Literally, our doors were open and the art was inside, but we had a little fire pit and some refreshments outside. And the theme that we asked the artists to consider was the acronym that Dove actually stands for, four words: dignity, opportunity, voice, and empowerment. So we asked the artists to riff on one or more of those words and what it meant to them, and that inspired the art that they gave us at the office. So that was a really cool way to, that happened to fall on October 1st, Friday, October 1st. So that was the way we kicked off DV Awareness Month on Vashon.
And my understanding is that domestic violence awareness is only part of what you do at Dove. Can you give us a little rundown of all the things that Dove does here on Vashon Island?
Oh, wow. we're kind of a little bit of a catch-all for a lot of different things. So, like, primarily it's domestic violence and sexual assault, advocacy, safety planning, safer planning. And then we work with individuals who are needing legal services for protection orders, restraining orders. We also have a therapy program now that's actually full. So I take on 8 clients who I see for trauma-specific therapy. We have our prevention programming. So in the elementary school, the middle school, and the high school, we do just education around healthy relationships and different things like that. And then we have our teen council, which is the peer sex-led education that we do in the middle and the high school. Anything else, Nin?
Yeah, we also have community engagement education and training. So later on this month, in fact, next Thursday. So what is the date of that?
I forget. October 21st.
Okay, thanks. I knew what day of the week it was, but yeah. So October 21st in the evening, we're doing online. We figured we'd stick with Zoom, you know, just for now with this whole Delta variant craziness. Yeah. But it makes it accessible to a lot of people that maybe otherwise wouldn't be able to come in person. So we're doing a community advocacy training. So we talk a little bit about the dynamics of domestic violence. And I think a lot of people, Susan, think about DV as black eyes and broken ribs. And while that physical assault, unfortunately, can certainly be part of what domestic violence is and how it shows up in a relationship, we look really more at patterns of coercive control in a relationship, because sometimes the abuse can be quite invisible to the outside eye. So it can be emotional, psychological, spiritual, even financial abuse. So just how to recognize what domestic violence might be, or toxic relationships, or just things of concern in the community, even if it's not directly related to DV, and how we might show up as a community advocate, as a bystander. And that's a little bit about what that training is, and just some skill building on, you know, some empathic listening, deep listening, reflective listening, and where to find resources, because we have to sometimes think outside the box in this community. We don't have a 24-hour crisis line. We don't have a shelter on the island. Mm. And so, you know, how can we pull together? Sometimes people are not quite ready to walk through our doors to talk to an advocate or see a therapist for their trauma, but they might confide in a neighbor, a cousin, a sister, a friend. And so how can we value safety as it belongs to all of us? And that's a little bit about what that training is. So we do trainings like that throughout the year. And last year, at the beginning of the year, we did a little, almost like a domestic violence 101 training for the fire and rescue, Bash on Fire and Rescue for the EMTs. Yeah. And that was something Rashawn and I did. It was really good. Yeah. We met, what, four or five times with the different EMT groups. So that's another example of our community engagement training.
So I'm curious about so much of this, but when you mentioned the EMTs and the fire department, was there anything, and if so, what was it that surprised you about their understanding and or their responses to what you were telling them about domestic violence and toxic relationships?
I think the biggest thing that was, I would say, like maybe a surprise to them was just about how it's really survivor led, what we do and what we're kind of expecting, you know, them to do. And then also that because of being an isolated island, the options are, there's not a lot of options really there. And a lot of people choose not to take the options off island. And so I think sometimes we think as outsiders that if we could just give people resources and support and a path that they're going to take it. But realistically, that's on them to make that decision, like what route they want to go down for their own lives. And I think people look for a solution in situations like this, and there's not necessarily a solution. And I think that's hard to sit with for a lot of people.
Well, that would, especially for the types who tend to be heroic.
Exactly. I was just going to say that same exact thing. You read my mind. Because when we think about someone who volunteers or who, you know, is part of the staff of fire and rescue, someone who is going to put on that uniform and go, they are solution focused. They want to save the day. They want to provide resources and have it matter in the moment. And I think the biggest conversation that was an aha for everyone in that training was that domestic violence work with survivors can take a long time. It's a slow process. As Rashawn mentioned, it's survivor driven, survivor led, trauma informed, and we keep the survivor in the center of their own experience and safety planning, frankly. So it's not about giving advice and expecting them to take that advice, or giving them a resource and being grouchy if they don't follow through with following that resource, right? It's not up to us and it's not about us. And there's also not sometimes a quick solution or an obvious solution. So if someone were to come to Fire and Rescue at 11 p.m. on a Saturday night, Dove is not open during that time. And I think Fire and Rescue, it was very sobering for them to realize, wow, there's not like some place we can just go take them. We can't deliver them to the doorstep of safety. And that's just sort of the reality of the work right now, is that it is a process.
And especially with the pandemic.
Oh my God, the pandemic has really changed everything in terms of wait times and saturation and availability of resources, certainly on the island as it always has been, but even off island. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what can a firefighter or an EMT do when someone comes to them at 11 p.m. in crisis?
Yeah. So, I mean, first off is like reflective listening and hearing the person, like where they're at in that moment. The second is, you know, we have given them like go bags and supplies, and we have given them hotel vouchers for certain amounts of stay, so that if somebody is in that crisis situation, if they're able to go off island, which is not always an ideal situation for everyone, then there's the opportunity for them to like assess and use those resources that Dove has provided them.
Wow, that's tough. That's really tough. So when you are teaching general members of the community, not EMTs or people from the fire department, about DV awareness and what they can do, can you elaborate on that a little bit? What would you tell me if I was, what should I be looking for, number one, in a friend or a neighbor? And if I learn from you that there is something that I am observing, what do I do? So number one, what should I look for? Number two, what the heck do I do?
Well, the first thing I would say before, like, what you do is to breathe. I think we, honestly, I think we forget that, like, we're human beings and we're dealing with, you know, other individuals who are struggling. And usually from the perspective of a family member or a friend, there's a need to, like, provide support and provide something for them. Whereas, like, you have to, like, center yourself and breathe first to be able to really stand in yourself and your grounding to be able to just, you know, hear what that person is telling you. So that would be my first suggestion, is to breathe.
In our work, we do that as well, because if you get swept up in someone else's crisis, you're not going to be in service to them in the same way as if you can show up grounded and open. And I think there is a sense that we want to be helpful and we want to solve. And sometimes people don't really necessarily want to confide in you as a friend or a neighbor to solve their problem or give them advice. Sometimes people just want to be heard and believed and validated. So I would say that those are the foundational steps in building rapport and trust. And I would say too that sometimes when people are in a domestic violence situation, they experience the feeling of that they're burning their bridges. So friends and family sometimes get frustrated, like, why don't you just leave? Why don't you just break up with them? Why don't you just, you know, and then they get irritated when it's been several months or even years and the survivor is still in that relationship. So I think sometimes being that, extending that unconditional positive regard for that person and just being that safe place where they know they can always land, so that when someone is ready to exit a toxic situation or relationship, it's on their terms when they know they're safe and they're ready and they've gathered enough resources and strength to do it in a way that works for them, as opposed to someone else's opinion or timeline or agenda. So I would say that communicating that to people is, how can we just listen openly instead of try to problem solve or fix or provide solution? And if that's what's asked for, then that's a different level of assistance, I think. And to know that there are other people around. So for example, Susan, we get a lot of calls at Dove from people who are concerned about someone else, right? Yeah. It's not even for themselves. And so that's an advocacy by extension, is how can we support the community to support other people? Because certainly, as I said before, not everyone is walking through our doors. Not everyone wants to. Not everyone is ready to. And that's okay. So really keeping the survivor at the center of their own experience, I think, is what is most important.
And it's we understand that it's difficult. Like, it's hard for somebody who you have an attachment to, be it like a daughter or a mom or a sister or a friend, see going through a hurtful situation. And not to say there are male survivors as well, so I want to highlight that. But to see that, that's very difficult and that's hard for you. But, you know, we always go back to, you know, this individual knows what's best for them at the best time. And so what can you do to provide what they're requesting, not tell them what they need to do?
Chris Austin does a show called Dove Speaks, yes. And I'm going to meet with him to do a pre-recording that will be aired next week, so the third and fourth weeks of October. But the topic of our conversation is going to be safer planning. So something that we do as domestic violence advocates is what's called safety planning. So if someone wants to exit their situation or change their situation, we try to work with them on what are they doing to keep themselves safe and how can they change their situation safely. And that safety planning can be different day to day depending on what's actually happening. But another concept that I think not as many people are aware of is safer planning. And that applies to people who are in domestic violence or toxic relationships and aren't ready to or have no intention of ever leaving their situation. And I think there's this misconception that people can't come to Dove unless they're ready to leave. And that's not true at all. We help quite a few people just stay safer in their relationship. Sometimes it's not possible for that person to exit their situation, or it's not the right time. So what are the tools and tactics we can do to support someone to stay safe in the context of their relationship?
You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I'm here with Dove advocates and instructors, Rashawn Renge and Nin Gray. And we're talking about Domestic Violence Awareness Month. When you folks are instructing individuals about awareness of domestic violence and what to do should they begin to recognize something among a friend or a within a friend or a neighbor, beyond actual physical violence, what sorts of toxic relationships fall into the category of domestic violence?
So there's multiple categories that kind of hit different, you know, areas of domestic violence. So, you know, we talk a lot about like financial abuse.
About what that is.
So it's, again, like with domestic violence, it's, you know, coercive control. And so the ability to control somebody financially. So talking somebody into quitting their job because then you'll support them full time, and then not allowing them to have finances, right? So different things like that, just managing the money around the situation where it's not collaborative. And that's, you know, there's difference between people who make more or less and how they deal with that in the relationship. But when there isn't any, you know, autonomy or any collaboration in regards to how finances are dealt with in a relationship, that can be, you know, abusive. There's also, you know, sexual abuse. So we talk a little bit, which is like trigger warning, but like marital rape happens often, where people are trying to stay within that relationship, but then you use sex as a way of control.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, obviously psychological. A majority of I would say what we see on Vashon is psychological abuse, which is just different kinds of tactics of, you know, following people on social media and getting in between their different primary relationships with friends, isolating, doing all these different kinds of name calling, or there's just many, many different things where somebody's just trying to control another person through the means of finances, sexual, psychological, different ways.
And what we look at for in terms of assessment when we're regarding abuse and if it's happening and what people might be asking for in terms of support, what we're looking for is a pattern of power and control. So not isolated incidences of, oh, I had an argument and, you know, I was mad, so I threw a plate across the room. Certainly, we're not advocating that as a healthy behavior of relating and communication. But, you know, stuff happens. But what we're not looking at, isolated incidences. And we know that even survivors of domestic violence can get angry and are often angry. So it's not, there's not a picture of this perfect domestic violence survivor that's passive and meek and weak. It's not about that. What we look at is there a pattern of controlling behavior over time? Has this financial abuse or isolation from friends and community and family been happening over time? And how does that look? So it's really about the pattern of coercive control is what Rashawn mentioned. And that's what we look at. And a lot of times I think when you're with a neighbor or a friend or a family member that you're concerned about, it's going to start, I think, on some level with a gut feeling, mm-hmm. right? It's that intuition that something's not quite right. And a lot of times someone who's surviving domestic violence will be very self-doubting, apologetic, uncertain, in denial that it's abuse. They will probably not use the words domestic violence
or abuse,
mm-hmm. right? So they're not going to call it those things. Very rarely does a survivor walk into our office and say, I'm a survivor of domestic violence. They don't label themselves in that way because that's not how they've been able to cope and stay in the relationship for that long.
I suspect they're not even sure they're surviving.
True. That's a really good point.
Yeah. Usually what we hear is, you know, like we're fighting a lot, like it's frustrating, like I feel like I'm being talked down to. There's just a lot of like general things that you may hear, you know, in a low level of a relationship. But then when you go through the assessment process, there's a very distinct pattern, like Nin said, over time of that coercive control that has gotten more and more detrimental to the survivor.
And we're looking at whose life is being made smaller in the relationship.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. That's very interesting. So if I, as a friend or neighbor, detect such a pattern, what do I do? Mm-hmm. How do I help? Can I help?
Mm-hmm. I think developing trust and rapport with someone with whom you're concerned and just letting them know that you're available for them if they ever want to talk, if they ever need a friend, that you just want to let them know that you're willing to be a non-judgmental person to listen to them with no agenda for what they need to or should do or not do, but that you're just there to listen and support and start there and then let it be led by that person.
So I can't say, that guy is a jerk. You need to get away from him. Not a good way to start.
Maybe something more like, wow, I'm really concerned. That doesn't sound like that felt really, that experience was, it sounds like you're really unsettled by that experience that you just described, or I've noticed this dynamic and I'm just wondering, are you okay? So you want to, I feel like this is actually a good point to bring up, because I think if you, as an advocate or a friend or a family member, villainize someone's partner, they're going to be resistant. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, 100%.
So that could contribute to the isolation.
Yeah. So we don't want to make them wrong for being in this relationship. Sometimes saying that guy's a jerk. And, you know, again, it's sort of sometimes maybe a survivor is ready to hear that. Like they want that validation, but really taking the cue off from them, because sometimes it's important to remember that people are still in love with their abusers.
Yeah.
Or share children with them and will for years to come. So how to hold all of that together as true at the same time.
And that's difficult, because that's a normal response for a lot of people. I mean, like, sure. I did consulting for other therapists on domestic violence cases, and even therapists who have training still have kind of judgments about what, you know, things should look like, and being able to sit back from a place of like, you know, like there's loving, caring feelings that were there and they just don't go away because, you know, abuse starts to occur. And so if you come from a place of understanding all of the sides of it, then that person will trust you more than they'll trust anyone else in talking.
And I wonder too, how often, I don't know if you actually work with couples, but how often have you seen a domestic violence situation, whether it be psychological, sexual, financial, whatever, diminish, heal? Does that happen?
We don't work with couples, so we support survivors of domestic violence. And if someone is in a domestic violence situation and we've assessed them as such, as a survivor, we certainly hope that their other significant other is getting help and getting counseling or whatever they need. But it wouldn't be appropriate for us to provide advocacy for both of those folks. So we suggest that people get separate counseling, and then maybe healing happens, maybe it doesn't. But we would never try to... Rashawn can speak more to this, but we would never provide couples counseling if there's domestic violence present.
From a therapeutic standpoint, like my stance and a lot of people who work with domestic violence, it's not really, I wouldn't consider it ethical, because you're coming into a situation of therapy where somebody has way more control and power.
Right.
And so then if you're trying to start that with somebody having way more control and power, my fear would be that we would start to talk about those things in therapy that then would put the survivor in danger when you go home, because that doesn't change over the course of 1, 2, 3 sessions.
Right. So when you're working with survivors, then how often do you see survivors' relationships heal from the survivor perspective?
Heal with their abuser?
Mm-hmm. Does it ever happen?
I mean, you know, I have to just be honest and say that we're not as close to there are people in the field that do perpetrator treatment or anger management classes, and there are people in the field that do a transformative justice work and restorative justice work, where they bring it survivor-centered based on what the survivor needs and wants, but bring people together for whatever it is the survivor would feel is healing. Sometimes it's an acknowledgement or an apology. And certainly that work is very potent, but we are more distanced from that work. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say that we know the answer to that question.
That's really interesting, because I'm just curious, and I'm not really suggesting the idea of working with perpetrators, but what is curious to me is how often you see survivors move on in healthy ways, whether they stay within a relationship or not. Maybe that's a better question.
Mm. I would say that we see a number of survivors that move on in a healthy way, usually within themselves as opposed to within a coupleship. I think there's a lot of that, like, trauma therapy work that's done, if it's familial trauma or relationship trauma. And we see a number of clients who just, you know, bloom and blossom, you know, because of the therapy or services or advocacy. And if they continue on with a partner or not, I mean, I don't know the future of that.
But. We provide empowerment-based advocacy. So when anyone becomes empowered, whether or not they're staying in their relationship or exiting their relationship or finding a new relationship, the more empowered that person is, the more they believe in themselves, the more they acknowledge what it is that they deserve as a human, which is to be safe and to be respected and to be, you know, supported, then they're going to advocate for themselves in all of their relationships moving forward. So that's the goal. And again, there's not a specific timeline, like by session 10, the person should have achieved this self-empowerment based goal. It's not really like that. So for some folks, you know, empowerment looks different than it does for others.
In our final minute, we have only 1 minute left. I can't believe
past.
It. You're offering these classes via Zoom. These are, give me the exact title, Community
Advocacy Training.
Community Advocacy
Training. 6 to 8 on the 21st. Plus, did you want to plug the intimacy workshop real quick, Michelle?
Oh, yeah. We also have the intimacy workshop, which is actually for theater individuals and or administrators that work in the theater to be able to come and get consent training for, like, on-the-job theater work, which is amazing. And we have 5 just brilliant trainers from Seattle.
It's an all-day thing. And when is that?
That one is on October 30th from 9 to 4, and that's sliding scale. So,
and for survivors specifically, we have one on October 29th led by the fabulous Julia, an author, fabulous facilitator and author Julia Anderson, who just came out with a book, Altars of Healing Workshop, that's specific for survivors. And we have a few spaces open for that one. And that will actually be in person, masked, social distance, on the 29th.
So where do I go to sign up for these? And number 2, if I can't attend, is there another way to get the information?
Yes. To get the information for the community advocacy training, you could contact Nin at her email, which is nyn@vashondoveproject.org.
And through our website, doveproject.org, is going to have the list of these events too. The information is not, none of these will be recorded, but I suspect we'll be offering these trainings again in 2022.
Great. Thank you both so very much. You've been listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHOP, Vashon Island, Washington. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime to chase the truth with our curiosity. And if you can't make it at lunch on Tuesday, we are at voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm so grateful for the time you've shared with us today. And thank you, Nin Gray. And Rashawn Rangley, I'm never going to get that right.
Okay.
I apologize.
Thank you, Susan, for having us.
So
it's been a pleasure.
The Dove Project is very active here on Vashon Island.